Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In the wake of three high-profile mass shootings in Buffalo, Uvalde, and here in Tulsa, a bipartisan group of senators are attempting to find common ground in developing federal legislation to lessen the possibility of gun violence. If senators can find agreement, and that's still a very big if, most observers expect the efforts to be marginal and peripheral to the overall effort to lessening the frequency of mass shootings. Back in April, I spoke with Mark Fulman, National Affairs Editor for Mother Jones and the author of Trigger Points, Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. We spoke right after mass shootings in Sacramento and Dallas that claimed the lives of 7 people and injured 27. Since that date, there have been 44 other mass shootings in America, killing 191 people and injuring over 650. Mark Fulman has been covering mass shootings for over a decade. In fact, he created the first-of-its-kind public database of mass shootings in America. In Trigger Points, Fulman examines the work by law enforcement and behavioral specialists to stop premeditated shooters and follows the groundbreaking method of behavioral threat assessment. This is a coordinated response between community mental health professionals, workplace HR officials and educational leaders, law enforcement, who help identify possible suspect behavior, then provide interventions to de-escalate that person's agitated emotional state with dignity to them, and yet, at the same time, remove an opportunity to do harm to others. I spoke with Mark Fulman back in early April. Mark Fulman, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
You've been covering mass shootings and the work in behavioral threat assessment for over a decade. You know, when we think about these events today, I think a lot of Americans have become almost inured to mass shootings and homicidal events until we're shocked by the next more heinous event. In your view, what are the biggest misconceptions Americans have about these horrific events?
Well, there are several big myths about them that we hear continually repeated every time there's a major mass shooting. One of them is the idea that essentially that the people who commit these mass attacks, whether in a school or a workplace or a shopping mall, that they're all totally insane and that they do this spontaneously, that they just snap, right? That's a question we hear often in the immediate aftermath. What made the guy snap? Well, nobody seems to know. And that really, none of that reflects the reality of these cases. If you look at the forensic evidence in all of these cases, these are people who have planned these crimes. They're predatory or targeted violent crimes, and they've been thought about and planned out over a period of time. Days, weeks, sometimes months. So the idea that mass shooters just snap, go off the handle, and go kill a bunch of random people isn't true. And the idea that this is all about mental illness, that these are caused primarily by mental illness, is also wrong. I think many Americans tend to think, because of the way that these stories are told primarily through the media, that most mass shooters are insane and are hearing voices. Maybe aliens are telling them to go kill somebody or kill indiscriminately. Also not true. The case research shows that in the majority of these cases, the perpetrators don't have clinically diagnosable mental illness. They have plenty of mental health problems and circumstantial and behavioral problems in their lives. They're not people who are doing well, but they're not necessarily mentally ill. Or in some cases where they are, mental illness may not be driving the motivation for what they're doing.
Yeah, they don't have a sense of altered reality, if you will,
that would
manifest itself in the most severe mental illness issues. So, beyond that, are there other misconceptions we have? I mean, I would like to talk a little bit about the idea that people snap. So you use a wonderful analogy in the book, which is you liken it to two members of the cat family. One is a cat that lashes out, like you're petting a cat in your home, and all of a sudden it doesn't take a liking. It bares its teeth. It maybe lashes out with its claws. And we think of that as what's happening in one of these mass homicidal events. You liken it to a cougar stalking prey, taking very careful, watching, planning, and there are all sorts of places where you could intervene prior to the pounce, if you will. And that's really what the focus of your book is on.
Right. And that's really what the opportunity and the mission of threat assessment work is, to try to prevent these attacks before they occur. Right. The cat analogy is based in the behavioral science that really supports the work of this field and the research of this field. And that's something that's been studied for a long time in terms of violent behavior in mammals, including human beings. So the cat example is really talking about the difference between what the field calls reactive or reactionary violence, exploding in a fit of rage or defensiveness to protect oneself or out of emotion, the way that a house cat might, or the other form of attack being predatory, planned and stalking, like the way that large cats hunt. I mean, small cats do that too, but that's the behavioral distinction in terms of the underlying science. There are a couple of other myths that this kind of connects into as well, as we were talking about earlier. Another is the idea that mass shooters can be profiled by their characteristics, that certain types of people will become mass shooters, or that you can predict that someone will commit a mass shooting. That is a misconception as well. People have tried to figure that out for a long time in criminology and in threat assessment research, and it's just not possible. So what this work does is look at behaviors and circumstances that lead up to these attacks, in which there are a number of patterns and types of warning signs, and really profiles the behavior itself. So that again connects in with the cat analogy, because you can see the kind of behaviors that exist around predatory behavior, stalking, waiting, watching, versus explosive emotional reaction in a reactive type of violence.
I would think within the law enforcement, there would be a tendency to really want to try to create a profile. And what your book points out is that anytime there is sort of a marker, if you will, I wouldn't even call it a profile. I would just say it's a marker, that it's a point of interest. You know, those have changed greatly over the 30 or 40 years. Law enforcement and health professionals have been really studying this issue.
Yeah, the real innovation of this field, which, as you mentioned, goes back almost four decades or more, depending on how you look at it, began with this collaboration of forensic psychologists and law enforcement experts trying to figure out how to stop violent crime, specifically assassinations. There was an original collaboration that I write about in Trigger Points early in the book, between mental health experts and agents at the U.S. Secret Service. They were trying to figure out, how else can we stop people from trying to attack the president? Can we figure out who's trying to do that and get in the way of it? And that prevention work really expanded over time into other issues: celebrity stalking, domestic violence, workplace violence, the rise of postal shootings in the 80s and 90s. And then, of course, what we think of now as the escalating school shootings era in the United States, that many people associate beginning with Columbine in 1999. And there were many school shootings before Columbine, but that's really the kind of major historical marker that people refer to now. And so really what the field's innovation was to understand that there are sets of behaviors and circumstances that lead up to an attack like this. And if we can find patterns in that, we can recognize what kinds of behaviors and warning signs that might indicate someone going down this road, we can try to get in the way of it through prevention work. So that's the real distinction. It's not about prediction, it's about prevention. Mm. And furthermore, the field really strives to intervene constructively with people. It's not inherently meant to be a punitive approach. So it was a real kind of remarkable shift, especially for law enforcement professionals, to think in this way. Traditionally, police don't try to prevent crimes. They solve crimes, right? They solve murders and lock people up, find evidence, and you know, participate in that criminal justice process. This was really a pursuit that was asking law enforcement to collaborate with mental health professionals to get in the way of crime happening.
Yeah. Another fact of this book is that many potential mass shootings have been prevented through this process, through behavior threat assessment teams and interventions that, as I'm glad you pointed this out, that intervention often, as much as possible, preserves the person of interest's dignity and tries to offer them real relief to their anguish and emotional state. And I found that very fascinating. Can you tell us about how this model evolved? There are two specific examples of prevention I wanted to talk about, but I would like to hear how that happened first.
Yeah, well, as I was mentioning earlier, it was initially through this research at the Secret Service studying the issue of assassination. And then it's interesting, the field really developed kind of organically, in a sense, like independently in different areas of the country and different agencies that were dealing with similar problems of trying to figure out preventing violent attacks, whether it was a mass shooting or an assassination attempt. There's another effort that started in Los Angeles in the early 1990s after a high-profile celebrity murder happened out there, a well-known case of a young actor named Rebecca Schaefer, who was stalked and murdered. And so these kinds of major historical cultural events, whether an assassination attempt or a celebrity killing, something like that, or a mass shooting, set off kind of waves of this early research in the field. What the experts who were looking into this were starting to discover was not only the trail of possible behavioral warning signs that could be helpful to prevention, they were also starting to see more sort of identifying characteristics of the problems themselves. You know, one thing we often hear in the aftermath of a mass shooting, invariably media will go out and interview people who interacted with the perpetrator in some form, maybe someone who was close to them or who interacted with them more sort of superficially. And we often hear the theme like, well, nobody could have seen this coming. This was just some quiet guy. He seemed so nice. And this was just unbelievable. Well, what the case evidence shows us is that that's really not true. It's a matter of people not recognizing the warning signs, right? Not having an awareness of the ways in which the field more and more came to understand could indicate somebody in a state of crisis, starting to think about a violent attack, planning it, preparing for it, things like collecting weapons, conducting surveillance of a venue they've decided to attack, drawing up a hit list of people they want to kill, or maybe just a place they want to attack that conceptually to them is important, but isn't necessarily about any specific person. So all these different kind of facets of these cases were continuing to build the knowledge of the field to answer the question, what is it that leads up to this? It's often very hard for us to answer the question of why someone does this, right? It seems crazy, it seems irrational. Often the question of motive in these cases is very complicated. But in some sense, the question of how is almost more important. How did someone get to the point of deciding to do this? What is it that led them there? What circumstances and conditions and what were they doing to indicate that they were headed that way? That's what the field calls the pathway to violence. So as we were talking about at the opening of the show, there's a process here that happens over time. And that's really the hope of the work. In a sense, the optimism of it is that these don't come out of nowhere. They're not instantaneous. They're not people snapping. There is a window of opportunity to intervene.
My guest today is Mark Fullman, a journalist and national affairs editor for Mother Jones, who created the first public database of mass shootings back in 2012. His new book is titled Trigger Points, Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America, in which he details behavior threat assessment teams working in schools, in other settings across the country, looking to identify these behavioral points and do interventions before tragedy strikes. And I do want to talk about two specific examples of prevention that you outline in the book. One was in the workplace and involved a difficult employee who warned of purchasing an AK-47 and not enduring a layoff. That was sort of one of the triggering episodes that it was, you know, it was a red letter threat. This was at a industry that involved making rocket fuel. So the idea of a workplace episode of violence could have been catastrophic. And the other one was a young man that is labeled Brandon in the book, in the Salem, Oregon school district, who made threats about having access to his parents' gun safe and making plans, even giving a day that he was going to come to shoot up the school. Can you talk about these two successful interventions? Because it gives us a sense, really, of how this intervention from the assessments work. And both of these were averted. I mean, nothing happened.
Right, which is also why we don't hear about them publicly. Yes. Because when nothing happens, it's not news. But it's the success of the work that is going on largely behind the scenes with these cases. So the first case you mentioned about the workplace threat with the guy who was talking about how he didn't, he told a manager he wasn't going to be a part of layoffs and mentioned getting this gun. It goes to your earlier question too about how the work goes about and why they go about why threat assessment teams try to go about addressing people's problems and grievances and concerns, the sort of root trouble that the person is going through that may be fueling an idea to go on an attack. And the reason is for that is that the field and its research was learning over time that kind of harsh treatment of that often was counterproductive and even dangerous. If you just fire someone like that and kick him out the door, because from the perspective of the company, you know, good riddance, he's gone, we don't have to worry about him anymore. Well, of course, we know of cases where those folks will come back or they may go attack somewhere else. So in that particular case, the company, upon the advice of threat assessment professionals that they had sought help from, including at the FBI, some early leaders in this field doing work, then they developed a plan to get this employee help, and basically said to him, you know, went to him and said, hey, look, what's going on? You know, we're worried about you and we want to help you out. And here's a way that we see a path forward here that could work. And they essentially offered him administrative leave and sent him to counseling. And he agreed and came back and was doing better. Then some things went wrong after that that were unrelated, but other workplace issues. He had some conflict with colleagues. And at that point, the company had decided that it had enough. But even then, from a threat assessment perspective, it was very important to terminate his employment carefully. And they engineered what they call in the field a soft landing, you know, making sure that he wouldn't be humiliated by his firing in any kind of public way, offering him some sort of support on the way out the door with some severance pay and things like that. And the reaction was quite remarkable. He essentially was grateful for how he was treated and understood why he was being let go. And that was the essential outcome of the case. Now, I should say, not every case is going to work like that. I think, you know, workplace conflict and struggles or troubling behavior in a school setting, you're going to have cases, and there are cases in the field where individuals aren't going to be responsive to that kind of help and may be hostile to it. But that is really the sort of ideal constructive work of the field. And there are a number of examples like that. The other one that you raised is a case I write about at length from the Salem Kaiser School District in Oregon, which is one of the early pioneers of this work in a school setting. They built their program shortly after Columbine. And I spent quite a bit of time with them in 2019, observing how they do this work and looking at cases. And this kid, Brandon, was one who had raised some serious concerns with a number of his behaviors and had made this comment about bringing a gun to school. So the team used a very proactive approach to figuring out what was going on with him. And they do this essentially by going out and gathering more information quickly from peers, from teachers, from family to try to figure out, you know, does he have a plan to commit violence? Is he serious? What else is going on that is causing him trouble? What else can we do to help him, to steer him onto a better path? And that's what they did through a number of constructive interventions with educational help, with counseling. And over a period of time, he was doing better and became more stable, and the threat was no longer there at that point. He went on, in fact, to graduate high school and was doing fine after that.
What was interesting about that case study was that there were several points along the way where you couldn't blame the people most intimately involved in the situation for maybe, you know, taking a different path. I think there was trouble at home. And at some point it was about, hey, we're going to send this child to another relative in another state. And, you know, of course, the intervention team said, no, don't do this. You're removing whatever support this child has in this situation. It's better to stay here. I mean, there's all sorts of places where it could have turned south. And rightly, you could see where people might say, well, this was probably the best suggestion or the best idea at the time. And the intervention team basically tried to build more structure underneath that person so that they had, you know, I guess, stronger legs to stand on, if you will.
Yeah, that was another case you're describing that I looked at with the Salem Kaiser team. Another high school kid who was of significant concern for potentially thinking about an attack. This was a kid who had become really interested and fascinated with the Columbine shooting, and there's a lot of that goes on now in the age of digital media. I write about this at length in the book too, the so-called copycat effect, and how this subject and the way that it's covered in the media and shared on social media has created some negative effects, particularly among youth. And this was one example of that. So, right, that was a really remarkable case, I thought, when I learned about it, that here was a kid who was raising serious red flags and the team was working with, and then the mother was going to send him away. And they were so concerned that would be destabilizing that they took measures to keep him in the community and continue to try to get him help and treatment. So, you know, that points to another aspect of this method that I have found so fascinating from the very beginning of learning about it roughly 10 years ago, which is that it ultimately is a community-based intervention method. And it relies on diverse expertise on a threat assessment team. Mental health, law enforcement are sort of the primary pillars, but in an education setting, of course, you have administrators and school counselors. In a corporate or workplace setting, you would have HR directors or other kinds of security and personnel professionals involved. And there are often some social services agencies involved. And it just, it shows how trying to deal with a complicated problem like this, it requires a complicated solution or a complex solution. There's no one thing that will fix it, just as there's no one thing that will predict it happening, right? So relying on a group effort of expertise to come together and figure out, essentially talking about, how do we manage a person who we're worried about and who we think is maybe going down this path, and continually tracking that and working with that person and monitoring it. It takes a process over time. But when it's done effectively, as I've seen with leading teams who do this, it's quite remarkable in its results.
My guest today is Mark Fulman, a national affairs editor for Mother Jones and the author of Trigger Points, Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. One of the questions I had is, how common are these behavioral threat assessment teams around the country? I would imagine in some places, you know, there are a lot of institutions like schools and the like are well equipped. In other places, I could imagine they're not equipped at all.
Yeah, it's a great question. And interestingly enough, it's pretty difficult to answer. And I've for no shortage of trying, as I was working on the book, I actually was just speaking with a couple of leaders in the field again recently about this. It has grown a lot in recent years. It's started to emerge as a concept nationally. You know, when I started looking into it 8-9 years ago, the term threat assessment, you couldn't even find really online. I remember Googling it and finding almost nothing. There had been nothing written about it in the general press. Now that's very different. Now that it's discussed often, there are actually a handful of states now that require it in the state's public school systems. The first to do that was Virginia. They did so in 2008 after the Virginia Tech massacre the year before, began requiring threat assessment teams at public colleges and universities, and then later extended that to K-12 schools. And then several other states followed. Initially, as I say in the book, it's sort of the policy sort of trailed major mass shootings where those were happening in states. So there was one in Illinois the following year in 2008, and that led to threat assessment being mandated in that state for universities. Now, I believe there are 8 or 9 states that require it, and there are several other that are considering legislation for it. Then there are also some other types of versions of this going on. As I mentioned earlier, there's a specialized team at the FBI that does this work within its behavioral analysis unit. This is the famous unit in the FBI known for its serial killer hunting that became, you know, the big stories in the 90s with the Silence of the Lambs and the Mindhunter book and Netflix series. This is kind of a next iteration of that work at the behavioral analysis unit, the team that does this. And I was able to spend quite a bit of time talking to the leaders of that team for the book too, and learning about their research. So they developed a model to essentially assist with this work nationwide. anywhere in a local community that might need help with threat cases that may not have the resources or the know-how to do it. And, you know, it tends to be more common in major institutions, major universities, metropolitan areas. The smaller communities may have less of it, but that's starting to change. And I think the field is growing quite a bit now and has the potential to really make an impact with prevention.
I want to ask you about your work because you worked on this book for 8 years. That's an enormous investment of time. And you've probably been working on this issue and writing about it and trying to understand it better for even longer than that. What are you trying to understand about this issue?
Yeah, well, I had the great fortune that this book really developed out of work that I was concentrating on in my role as a writer and editor at Mother Jones. I started really focusing on mass shootings as a societal problem a decade ago in 2012, when it was a terrible year. If you recall, that was the year of Sandy Hook, and the year before that, summer before that, the mass shooting at the movie theater in Aurora, Colorado. And those events really had grabbed my attention in a way. I had covered such events previously and gun violence as a subject, but at that point, I had really started to grapple with a couple of key questions about this problem. One was, why don't we know more about this? Is it happening more? I couldn't find much good publicly available data on it, specifically on those types of public mass shootings. And that was the inspiration for building the database that you mentioned that we created at Mother Jones. And I've continued to, unfortunately, build that database out over the past 10 years. And in the course of that work, developed this interest in this prevention work. I think for me at the root of it too is really just the kind of thematic question of why can't we make better sense of this? You know, we regard these as senseless tragedies that can't really be explained or that we can't really do anything to stop because we live in a society with so many guns and we're constantly having the same debates about gun laws and people have the sense that nothing ever changes, which isn't true at all. There's been a ton of change on the issue of gun violence and gun regulations at state and local levels. It's the federal level where nothing really changes. Mm. But for me, it was just, you know, realizing, well, of course we can make sense of this problem. It's complicated, but our country's done all kinds of amazing, complicated things in terms of solving problems and innovating. And so for me, it was really pursuing that. And this learning about this field of work, behavioral threat assessment, I found it to be very rich territory. It's really, it's about human behavior, right? As the name suggests. We're all familiar with the political debate over, well, this is not a gun problem or this is a gun problem. Well, it is, of course, a gun problem. You can't have mass shootings without guns, but it's bigger than that. It's more complicated than that. It's also a human behavioral problem. And I have found that to be endlessly fascinating and intrinsically hopeful because this is a behavior we can understand. It's something that human beings do. And if we can understand it better, then we can stop it better.
The name of the book is Trigger Points. Mark Fullman, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Mark Fullman is a journalist and the national affairs editor for Mother Jones. I spoke with him back in early April when his book, Trigger Points, Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America, was first published. It's published by Day Street Books. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.